next case is Christian Diaz, appellant versus Debbie Sundgren, who's the warden. Then this case is set for 15 minutes per side. So appellant can lead off here.
And thank you.
I want to remind the parties and others that we will take a break at the close of this argument.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Pablo Almazan for Christian Diaz, and I'll aim to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I just like to note, it looks like the clock is frozen right now on 1:45, so should I just wait for that to get reset?
Is the clerk...
Apologies, judges. Ms. Garul had dropped off the call because of a computer glitch. Let me restart the clock for you.
Thank you.
I think your clock is now set.
Thank you.
Use them wisely.
I'll try my best, Your Honor. Diaz's trial boiled down to a credibility contest between the arresting officers and Diaz's sister as to whether he committed a gun assault that, per the officer's own concession, could have only been pulled off if Diaz had, quote, unheard of strength. In closing argument, the prosecution repeatedly told the jury that they should believe the officers over Diaz's sister because these officers had no motive to lie. But this wasn't true. The only reason the prosecution was able to argue that the officers lacked the motive to lie about the disputed gun assault was because the trial court did not allow the defense to bring evidence of that motive into trial. I'd like to focus today on 2 points. First, how the excluded use of force investigation did provide a motive for the officers to lie about the gun assault. And second, how exclusion of this investigation from trial prejudiced Diaz. First, regarding the motive. If we assume that the disputed gun assault never happened and focus instead only on the undisputed events on the night in question, it becomes clear why the officers would have benefited from a lie about the gun assault. We know that in response to a welfare check, the officers entered Diaz's bedroom and then eventually tackled him to the floor. Once Diaz is on the floor, 2 officers with a combined weight of 400 pounds get on his back, while a 3rd officer begins to repeatedly tase Diaz for a total of 5 times. There's also no dispute that when this happens, Diaz only weighed 130 pounds, that Diaz also had visible red marks on his face as a result of this altercation, and that one of the officers who was on top of Diaz has cuts to his knuckles that may be consistent with having punched someone. So in this situation, would the officers benefit from them saying they had a gun, that Diaz pulled a gun on them? We know immediately after they arrest Diaz that an uninvolved sergeant arrives to begin a use of force investigation on the officers. If we look at, at the situation they're faced in now, they essentially now find themselves having to explain, why all of these actions were reasonable. Why did they have to repeatedly tase Diaz 5 times when 2 officers who greatly outweighed him were already on top of him? And they also have to account for these injuries.
To succeed on this claim, you would need to show that no reasonable jurist would have excluded the evidence, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, the Court of Appeal in the first appeal said the trial court did not abuse its discretion. We agree that with the trial court that the evidence of the internal investigation would have been more prejudicial than probative, in particular because defense counsel sought to introduce evidence that the officers were investigated for their use of force, but to exclude evidence of the results of the investigation. So we would have to find that those jurists, for example, were unreasonable in making that determination, because if they're right, you lose, right, on this point?
I mean, so the CCA opinion isn't the one we're looking at. It is
no, I understand
the Supreme, but no, obviously,
but it's certainly an example of jurists, and
sure,
certainly jurists on the Court of Appeal, and you're saying that that by definite that that has to be unreasonable, because if that was reasonable, then you would lose because they would be some reasonable jurists, right?
Sure. So a couple points I want to make there. Is first, defense counsel at the pretrial hearing on whether or not this evidence should come in, they never said, we only want this evidence in trial if we could also avoid having the results come in. They do say that we don't, and I believe the words are, we don't necessarily want to talk about the results, but then they explain because those results were basically irrelevant as to whether the investigation itself.
Right. They say our position would be that the investigation is relevant, but the results are not relevant.
Correct, and I would agree with that assessment. And the other thing I would like to point out is that the prosecution, in responding at the pretrial argument, they do tell the trial court, hey, if this investigation comes in, then we also want the results in. So basically, the trial court was presented with that option. But what they did is they didn't decide, well, it's going to be too messy. They essentially decided, well, the probative value of the investigation itself is just not so high that it warrants coming into the trial. Sorry, I thought you were going to say something.
No, I'm sorry. But the California evidentiary rule is very similar to Rule 403, right?
Correct, yes.
All right, go ahead.
Sure. So, and I think, you know, to kind of get to this point, It's we have to go back and see, did this investigation provide a motive for them to lie? And again, the officers, once that uninvolved sergeant arrives on the scene shortly after the arrest, they know at that point they're under investigation. Like, they don't have to guess or wonder, you know, are our actions going to be under
the mic? But I mean, what you have to show first is that it was a clear violation of the Constitution for the Superior Court to balance the probative value against the prejudicial value and find that under the California evidence rule, that the finding that they made that the probative value was outweighed, that was a violation of the Constitution that no reasonable jurist could disagree with. Not just that it was relevant, but that its exclusion violated the Sixth Amendment and that every reasonable jurist would have to agree, not just that it was relevant. I'll give you that it was relevant.
Sure. So in this case, it's one that did boil down to a credibility contest because there wasn't any undisputed evidence that showed that Diaz actually did this assault. So, you know, and we could see the fact that this was a credibility contest because the prosecution in closing repeatedly says, you know, these officers don't have a motive to lie. Where's the motive? They don't have a motive to lie. Diaz's sister is the only one with the motive because of the family connection. So when we have a case where it essentially boils down to a credibility contest, whether a motive to lie exists is really what the whole case turns on. And if one side is able to argue that their witnesses have no motive to lie and that's why you should believe them, that's a pretty powerful argument, right? But we know that had the investigation come in, they can't make that argument, and then their sell to the jury becomes much tougher because now they have to go out of their way to explain
judges make these kinds of determinations all the time that, I mean, you don't even get to what we would call the 403 balancing unless the evidence is relevant. Because if it's not relevant, there's nothing to balance. So in 403 decisions all the time, you're balancing the probative value against the danger of unfair prejudice. And at least one of the things that the state has identified, and I think the Superior Court judge did too, is it's unfair because the jury's the jury hearing this might well assume that they were found guilty in this internal affairs investigation, and that's unfair. So, I mean, isn't that a legitimate consideration by the district court? Would it be unfair if the jury could think these crucial witnesses were found guilty by their own organization of significant misconduct?
So in that, if that is the concern, then they should, you let in the results as well. And that's...
Well, then, for example, the Court of Appeal found that that's not what they wanted. They didn't want both. And, I mean, I think that's a fair reading of the transcript.
Again, I would push back there because, again, they say we don't want to necessarily talk about the results. And then they go on to explain how they're irrelevant. And again, the trial court was given the option when the prosecution says, well, if the investigation comes in, we want the results to come in too.
Is there anything in the record in which counsel said, Judge, we'd take both? If the only way we can get the investigation in is to find out that they were exonerated, we'll take both.
Not from counsel's words directly, but again, prior to that, the prosecution did present that option to the court. It was the court who basically said, because the results turned out favorably for the officers, I just don't see the probative value, and that's why it's not coming in. And I obviously, I believe that decision itself was wrong because that would assume essentially that the way the investigation was, that it essentially was so foolproof that it exonerates the officers of any wrongdoing. You know, obviously, if we had known more about the policy and how it works, we would know that the police report that the officers draft is what kind of serves as the benchmark for that investigation, and that all the evidence is then compared to that narrative. And essentially, if it's consistent, then, you know, most likely it's going to come out in favor of the officers. So it's, to me, it's, again, what I think is important to realize is this case did come down to credibility. And essentially, the defense is then not allowed to argue or attack the credibility of the officers. And the prosecution repeatedly takes advantage of that in closing by arguing the officers have no motive to lie and saying, you know, where's the evidence of this conspiracy that they made up this lie? So again, it's, I guess one more point I also want to make is that, you know, courts, Van Arzel, Ortiz v. Yates, Holly v. Youngborough, they repeatedly have held that when courts completely exclude motive evidence, that is a constitutional violation.
Do you have any case that you can cite, because I don't see that in the Supreme Court case, where the court has said excluding it completely after balancing is a Sixth Amendment violation, as opposed to it completely excluding relevant, important evidence is a violation of the Sixth Amendment? Is there any case you can point to where they make that same supposed unconditional statement when they're looking at a determination by the trial court of balancing relevance, probative value against prejudice?
So I can't think of a case off the top of my head, but again, I would say the trial court just got the prejudice ruling wrong here. Again, to them, the whole probative value of the investigation goes out the window just because they believe that the results were in favor of the officers. So if you have that kind of, you know, I think wrong decision, then you can't really rely on that balancing analysis that they did, because at that point it's flawed. And so then we do look as to what the proper analysis should have been. And I do see that I'm running low on time, so unless the court has any other questions, I would like to reserve the remaining for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Lindsay Boyd on behalf of the warden. Established federal law is clear that the right to confrontation under the Sixth Amendment does not mean the right to bring in irrelevant, misleading.
Counsel, hold on.
Yes.
I think we need to... If the clerk set the clock for you.
My apologies, Your Honor.
It's okay. No. Yeah, thank the clerk. There you go.
Thank you. Established federal law is clear that the Sixth Amendment does not mean a defendant can bring in misleading, irrelevant, or unduly prejudicial evidence. The trial court in this case properly excluded any reference to the internal affairs investigation just for that reason, that it was irrelevant, misleading, confusing, and unduly prejudicial. And the California Supreme Court did not unreasonably apply binding federal precedent when affirming the trial court's ruling. I take issue with opposing counsel's representation that the defense was not able to argue that the officers had motive to lie. And I'll just read from the defense's closing argument at the second trial, which begins at 5 ER 1071, where the defense counsel says they didn't want to lose their jobs. They did not want to lose their jobs. They didn't want to sit in the hot seat. They didn't want to sit in Mr. Diaz's seat. So there was a concern about how can we justify this beating. Essentially, the defense's entire argument was that the police officers came up with a story to justify an unjustified beating. Having an internal investigations report come in, which in fact said to the contrary, that the police officers were justified, would have, undermined the defense's argument.
Isn't part of their argument that at the interval between the original report and the supplemental report, this investigation had begun?
That's correct, Your Honor. So it seems
so if their argument is the supplemental report is a lie, the fact that in the interim an internal affairs investigation had begun, and therefore they knew that they needed to clean up what they wrote to put the finger on the trigger stuff in the supplemental report. It seems to me that the fact that during that interim they were being investigated is certainly relevant. I mean, that doesn't go to the question of balancing, but you're arguing it's not relevant, and I don't see that.
Well, I think it's not relevant in the sense that the tasing, which essentially the petitioner is arguing that they had to come up with a story of producing the gun to justify the tasing. The story was he was tased four or five times before the gun was even produced. So the nexus between what the officers said happened doesn't even really meet what petitioner is trying to portray the argument as. I think the second point is that it does go to the balancing, that whether or not the fact that this investigation was taking place has anything to do with a motive to lie. Because a jury could also look at this and say that officers had motive to be even more truthful because they knew that their police reports are going to be read by people outside of their normal channels, and that they had to, you know, amend the police report to make sure that all of the details were accurate because it was undergoing this level of review.
Respectfully, counsel, I think that argument kind of cuts against you, because if you can make that argument, that reduces the danger of unfair prejudice.
Well, so first, I think, importantly, the defense was able to cross-examine the officers about any discrepancies in the police report. So, you know, applying Van Arsdale under the AEDPA lens, whether or not the jury would have gotten a significantly more different view of the officer's credibility. The defense was able to cross-examine the officers about any discrepancies in the police report. Secondly, whether or not this investigation really gave the officers a motive to lie would necessarily require evidence presented about whether their use of force was justified. Because if the officers tased petitioner and it was apparent to everybody who was present there, and there were many officers present there, that no one did anything wrong, then they wouldn't have a strong motive to lie. On the other hand, so it would, as the trial court said, it would have created a trial within a trial, because the jury would have had to have heard all this evidence about use of force and the police conduct, which wasn't relevant to what the jury was actually tasked with deciding. The only way that petitioner's argument makes sense is if the jury started from the presumption that the officers necessarily were going to lie, again, they could have also concluded to the contrary. And whether, and also the jury would have only had to have heard the part that there was an on the fact of the investigation, but would have had to not heard the results of the investigation, which in fact undercut the defense's argument. The defense's argument was essentially that these officers had an unjustified beating and had to make up a story to justify it. And if a police report is introduced, which comes to the opposite conclusion, it doesn't help the defense's argument in that case. It undermines it. So applying, again, the very deferential standard of AEDPA, the question is not only whether or not the trial court was reasonable in excluding the evidence, but whether or not any reasonable jurist could have found that the trial court was reasonable. I think under that lens especially, it's clear that the petitioner's confrontation clause rights were not violated by excluding the internal affairs investigation. However, I want to address the second prong of petitioner's argument, which is the prejudice requirement, which is the Brecht standard. Again, we analyzed in our briefing the applying the Van Arsdale standards as well as the Brecht standard. I think it's a little unclear from the case law how those two standards meld together. But essentially, the question is whether or not there was a substantial or injurious influence on the verdict. In this case, the internal affairs investigation was not relevant, even if they were going to argue that the finger on the trigger evidence was somehow that somehow brought in because of the internal affairs investigation. Again, none of this evidence was relevant to the questions that the jury was tasked with determining. And the jury also heard from Dr. Gelman, who was corroborating testimony about the petitioner's behavior that evening. The defense was permitted to cross-examine the police officers. They called Officer King as their own witness and was able to examine them about any discrepancies in their police reports. And the prosecution's case was very strong. Even petitioner's own sister heard the police officers say, gun, gun, gun. So the defense's argument that the gun was never produced was simply not credible. And unless your honors have any additional questions, I'm happy to submit early. I think I addressed most of what counsel raised.
Okay.
We would ask that this court affirm the order of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Just a few points I'd like to make in rebuttal. Counsel mentioned that, you know, the defense was able to argue, you know, that the officers were motivated by this concern that they would lose their jobs. But without the investigation at trial, essentially what the officers had to rely on for their theory of the case was that the beating had been so bad on Diaz that any person looking at those injuries would automatically assume, okay, yeah, you know, we're going to get investigated for this. There's a potential that we're going to get reprimanded. And what the prosecution said in closing is, where's the evidence of this massive beating? Although he did have red marks on his face, you know, where are the cuts? Where are the bruises? Where are the broken bones? So it shows you the harder, you know, sell that case was for the defense without the investigation. As to the discrepancies that were kind of teased out on cross-examination for the officers, those were mainly that the officers testified inconsistently about whether the tases affected Diaz and whether Diaz's sister was in the bedroom. But in closing, again, the prosecution offered innocent explanations for these inconsistencies. She said that these officers had different vantage points. You know, some are on the floor, some are standing up, some are in the hallway. She says it's a fast-acting situation. And as for the officer who actually tased Diaz, she essentially calls him a novice and says that he didn't know what he was doing and couldn't essentially tell whether or not someone was being affected by a tase. So again, without the motive to lie investigation in, these cells become much easier for the prosecution to make. As to whether or not this was a close case, I mean, we have a data point here, and that's the first trial that resulted in a hung jury. And really, the only primary difference between the first trial and the second trial was that at the second trial, the ER doctor testified for the prosecution. But that testimony didn't move the needle as to whether or not Diaz actually committed the disputed gun assault. All she testified was that he was difficult to control in a hospital setting where they're essentially trying to place an IV in him and a catheter. And just lastly, you know, the gun and the fact that the sister corroborated that the officers yelled gun. Well, that's entirely consistent with the story where the officers are on top of Diaz as they're struggling with him. They notice a gun in his bedroom because there was four total guns recovered. And he's yelling out gun, gun, gun to notify the officers, hey, there's a gun over there. Someone go get it. And again, why would Diaz's sister, if she's being motivated to lie about this? Like, why would she tell this? It has no kind of benefit to Diaz. And my last point is, again, this case did boil down to a credibility contest, but one where the defense was not allowed to attack the credibility of the officers. And I don't see how anyone could believe that that didn't prejudice Diaz or violate his confrontation clause rights. And unless the court has any other questions, I would submit.
So I have no questions. Been hearing none from the other judges. This case shall now be submitted and the parties will hear from us in due course. We'll now be on, take a short break.
This court stands in recess.